lecture number 20 is not the one that is scheduled, which is on the negotiated talk, that sort of thing. That will come next week. This lecture is on the final years and the final days of the Vietnam War. If time permits, I would like to say a bit about several other aspects about the Vietnam War, the communication process, Sino-Soviet dispute, the intelligence world in Saigon. I probably won't have time for most of these, so I'll try to work them in at some later lecture. The treatment here is not chronological. As I say, we skip over the political settlement business. Paris talks, come back to that later. This lecture will deal with the final period of the war, the final sad days. It began with the withdrawal of American and Allied forces, the famous 60 days of March and April 1973. Havan and what was left of the PLAF, South Viet Cong forces, had been badly mauled by 8 years of combat, and they began to rebuild, to re-equip, mostly with the help of the Soviets. General Giap began plans for a new offensive. This was set for mid-1976. In the meantime, there would be a return to lower-level Dao Chan and something of a continuation of the fight-fight-talk-talk period we just talked about last week. Arvin, South Vietnamese, meanwhile, had been transformed into a Western-style military machine of such high technology that it could not sustain itself without American assistance. Slowly, its fighting ability declined, as did, perhaps more importantly, its sense of self-confidence. It had been the GVN, South Vietnamese, assumption that the U.S. would continue to support the war effort, although not with ground troops. This was interpreted in Saigon as meaning that if there were another major Havan North Vietnamese attack, U.S. air power, particularly the B-52s, would return. And that indeed had been the intention of the Nixon administration at the time the Paris agreements were signed. However, the political turmoil that developed in Washington in the Watergate affair so beleaguered the Nixon and then the Ford administrations that further military assistance to the GVN became impossible. This was the so-called death of the imperial presidency. South Vietnam thus became a major victim of Watergate, along with Richard Nixon. The history of the final period, very briefly, we talked about last week, the Easter offensive weekend of 1972 proved not to be militarily decisive. U.S. strategy came to be to withdraw its forces at a sufficient pace to reduce domestic criticism in the United States while attempting to convince Hanoi that the U.S. had continued determination and implacability. Credibility. Hanoi's calculation was that the domestic difficulties would prevent the U.S. from sustaining its war effort, and that shortly, it would be forced into abrupt and total withdrawal. Again, that was 1972. But it did not obtain. And the war continued. With the so-called 1972 Christmas bombing as goad, Hanoi officials reluctantly concluded they should negotiate American withdrawal. Paris agreements on the Vietnam War were signed in February and March of 73. They arranged for the departure of American troops. They also authorized the Pavan to keep 40,000 troops in South Vietnam. The meaning of this was that the war would continue. but without the Americans. It would become, once again, essentially an indigenous affair. A fairly complicated development, and that's what I'll go into next week. Almost immediately, there began what was called the War of Flags between the contending forces in South Vietnam, the Arvin, GVN, and the Pavan troops, who had been permitted to remain in the South. And they were fighting both the full military and the paramilitary of the South Vietnamese forces. The War of the Flags came from the condition that in villages a GVN flag would be run up and a VC unit would come in and tear it down and run up their flag. And then the next day an Arvin unit would come in and tear down their flag and put up the GVN flag. There's a so-called leopard spot arrangement. The idea was somehow to try to establish a clear identification of who was who and where was where. But in that kind of a war, it was simply impossible. It was too fluid to begin with. Now, this continued for about 20 months. Then, in December of 1974, General Giap authorized an offensive, and a limited offensive, a very small scale, a province size offensive in the province of Phuc Long. I think it's on your map here. It's straight north of Saigon, up near the Cambodian border. Phuc Binh is the capital. I don't know if it's clear on that map or not. Anyway, this was a very small-scale Pavan attack, and to the surprise of all, it proved, including the high command in Hanoi, I think, overwhelming victory. The fall of Phuc Binh, which was the capital of Phuc Long, was enormously traumatic on Nguyen Van Thieu, president of South Vietnam, and the Arvin generals. It was, in a way, the turning point in the war, the beginning of the end. We didn't know that at the time, but became evident later. Hanoi, I think, was surprised, and we found that out later too, by the suddenness of the victory, the complete quality of the victory, and the fact that when the provincial capital fell, the whole provincial defense structure crumbled, collapsed. And they were further surprised by the stunned reaction in Saigon. The judgment, and what I think what you can hear in Hanoi today, was that the Phuc Binh campaign was designed as a kind of sop to Pavan generals in the south who wanted to resume the war, were rested over the idea of waiting until 1976, U.S. election year, for the last hurrah. So the high command authorized this limited offensive in the northern half of a relatively small and unimportant province, which surprisingly ended in the capture of the whole province. So General Giap and the high command immediately readjusted and raised their short-range military goals, still intending to make 76 the year of the final campaign, but it decided to step up the pressure a little bit, began to consider more ambitious undertakings. Initially, we now know there was a plan for an attack on Tay Ninh province, which is between Saigon and the border in the northeast. Apparently they had bad vibrations about this in Hanoi, so instead they moved to the highland to hit Ban Ma Thuot. You can see that right above the inn in Vietnam, straight north of that. Pavan was better prepared for attack on, better equipped and better positioned, and it would permit older Viet Minh-style warfare. If it succeeded, the high command thought there could be a drive to the sea to cut the country in half. as had been the effort in the Easter offensive, just straight down Highway 14. Well, Arvin got wind of this plan through intelligence, and it reinforced Ban Matur. And so I got thinking that Arvin had not been prepared for Phuc Long, but they would be at Ban Matur, and it would be another story. Came the initial Pavan assault on Ban Matur, and actually it was more of a probe than a full-scale attack, and Ban Matur just fell. It proved to be the last true battle of the war. Arvin troops panicked. They fled down Highway 21 to the sea with Pavan troops right behind them. When they got to the sea, Highway 1, which ran along the sea, the whole coast of Vietnam, and they headed for Saigon. We were getting NSA high top secret intercepts of the message from General Giap to his troops in the field, to the generals that were at this point of the sea. And the sense of this over several days, as they were turning south and moving south quite rapidly, the Giap message was saying, "You're moving too fast. You're walking into a trap. Slow down." And the messages would come back, "Yeah, we hear what you're saying, but believe me, there is the resistance is just crumbling. So we're moving as fast as we can, because that's the proper way to do it." I think it was just a natural caution on Giap's part, and if he couldn't believe and Arvin had crumbled the way it had crumbled, because Arvin had stood and fought under far worse conditions in the past, and now it wasn't fighting at all. This was compounded by the fact that General Q, up at the DMZ, pulled his troops out of the line between North and South Vietnam and pulled them back to Saigon, and it just left the whole military situation in Northern and South Vietnam in chaos, area from Hue and Da Nang north. And so other Pavan troops then crossed from North Vietnam into South Vietnam, came down the coast toward Hue and toward Da Nang. There was some resistance along the way, but it was never what could be called a true battle. Arvin had become so disorganized that it could not fight as a coherent army, even if individual members of the unit wanted to, and some individual units did fight, almost to the last man. But it was a kind of inexplicable collapse. Most of the Arvin soldiers that came to this country blamed Q entirely for it. He certainly shares a large share of it, but it's very much like France, I think, in World War II. France was the most powerful army on earth. It had the great Maginot Line. And then when the first days of World War II, they had the so-called phony war. But then the Germans began an offensive, and the French army just collapsed. And nobody has ever really been able to explain why this happened exactly. It's still terribly embarrassing to French in France today. I gave lectures there at times, and afterwards I'd try to draw these, some of them who'd been in the army, draw them up. What happened? Is it parallel to South Vietnam? Or why did South Vietnam collapse? Why did France collapse? I didn't want to talk about it. Anyway, the point was that Arvin, which had stood and fought under far worse conditions, did not stand and fight at all, chiefly because it couldn't. I mean, the chaos, the disruption, performance, I think, of some of their officers. I will give you an explanation for this later. It's the one you get from the thoughtful Vietnamese. Doesn't entirely hold water, but it's the best explanation I can come up with. At any rate, Pavan continued down Highway 1 until they reach Saigon. And then at 11:30 in the morning of April 30th, 1975, Pavan Tank 843, Soviet-built Tu-54, commanded by Captain Bui Quang Tin of the Pavan 203rd Armored Brigade, crashed through the wrought iron gates of Independence Palace in Saigon, and the Vietnam War was over. Well, almost over. 4 years later, Christmas Day 1979, Tank 843, now with a new commander, crossed the border into Cambodia, spearheading Pavan's fateful invasion of that country. I think 843 is still in Cambodia. I made an effort once in Cambodia to find it. Anyway, that began the post-war period, the war aftermath, which is the topic of Lecture 26. All right, anything, any questions, any comments about the last hurrah? Well, I'd like to say a bit now about the communication process in the Vietnam War. I think I've told you this is one of my specialties, but I think it's terribly important to understand it. I want to understand the war. There are three basic means by which ideas in any society can be systematically communicated. The first of these are mass media, which is radio, television, newspapers, magazines, books. These are the ones you're most familiar with. Well, you're familiar with the others, too. Second is informal channels of communication. This is the way most information has traveled through most of man's history. These other media are fairly recent, the last couple hundred years. Informal channels of communication means a word of mouth, rumor, a gossip, what the talk in the village markets, itinerant peddlers, travelers coming through, very informal, very powerful means of communication. We've done quite a bit of research on this. Did a big research on, for example, in India with the death of Gandhi. This was kept off the radio for about 24 hours. So the question was, who in India heard about this before then? This is what the research did. And it was really amazing how well informed, I mean, everybody in India knew about this within hours, I mean, like 3 or 4 hours. And when in the research, the question was, when did you hear about this and how did you hear about it? And mostly it was along main highways. It was assumed that these were buses and trucks and so on who would drive, and they would tell people this, and then it was spread out. But it was the rapidity with which that information flowed through this channel of communication that was so impressive. We did work in Vietnam on this sort of thing. Some information goes very quickly, some doesn't go at all. We used to plant rumors. We tried to find out where these rumors were heard and how did you hear them. And rumors about the death of Ho Chi Minh. And, next thing you know, we get this AP story from Hong Kong saying Ho Chi Minh is dead, according to reliable reports in Saigon. But some information would flow very quickly, some wouldn't flow at all. We changed the rationing of pork in the markets of South Vietnam. So we did research on among housewives, where did you hear about this and when and so on, and found out almost none of them ever heard it from another housewife or another woman or another anything. Almost every case they found out when they went to the market. The change was you could buy pork only Monday, Wednesday, and Friday rather than all week. But almost everybody found out this when they went to the market on Monday, Wednesday, or Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, and couldn't buy a part. I don't know why that news, that information wouldn't spread, but this is one of the puzzling things about informal channels of communication. All right, the third medium is social movements or social organizations, in which the organization itself acts as a channel. For example, a church, or the Boy Scouts, or a fraternity, or a trade unions, or PTAs. These are channels of communication. They communicate not only ideas, but also information and value judgment. So those are the three: mass media, informal channels of communication, and social organizations. Pinoy used all three, but they relied on the third, the social movement, as their chief medium of communication. Yet no more can be studied in communicational context. And we argued, for example, that everything Hanoi did was conceived and executed as an act of communication. It maintained a vast information effort throughout the war to influence the world's perception of itself and of the war. Its organizational structure in the South, the Viet Cong apparat, was specifically designed as a medium of communication. Political struggle in the cities, and even its military actions, I think, were intended in many ways to convey ideas. In a different but equal manner, the other side also sought to communicate to the other side its interest in a settlement, for instance, to the world, what it was doing in Vietnam and why, and to itself as to what the war was all about. Hanoi's use of communication went beyond the normal social role as understood elsewhere. It did communicate data, it explained it in meaningful terms, it provided a value judgment based on individual relevancy. That's the more or less traditional communication function everywhere. But it also shaped communication as a weapon and used it to strike at the vitals of the South Vietnamese people. Hanoi's victories and defeats were essentially, in many cases, the result of successful or unsuccessful communication efforts. Institutionally, this effort took four forms. First, communication by means of the village social movement or social organization, specially created by Hanoi in the village, the Vietnamese villages, as communicational vehicles. Workers' Liberation Association, Students' Liberation Association, Women's Liberation, Intellectuals, and so on. These were formed to serve a purpose of the individual member of the organization, but it was also meant as a means of communication. Whole structure of the Liberation Association complex. Second, communication by means of the armed propaganda teams and agitprop teams. They roamed the rural areas and the GVN-controlled areas, staging meetings and propaganda lectures. They'd stop a bus on the Saigon-Dinh Highway, take everybody over to the bamboo grove and give them a lecture, and then let them go back on the bus. Thousands of those activities went on every day all over the country. Third, a communication of an indoctrinational nature among the insurgents themselves and their followers. This included lectures and various training courses and regular criticism and self-criticism sessions, Kim Tao, they were called, which people got up and they criticized themselves, or they criticized other people at the meeting, or they criticized the cause. There are certain rules of how you did this, but it was encouraged. I think it was a little like a confession in the Catholic Church. It had a therapeutic value. It kept the cadres informed as to what was people's gripes. But it gave gave a sense of participation. You let off steam. You get mad at something, you can get up and criticize it. you know, it was not a fascist type organization where you could be shot for criticizing Ho Chi Minh. It's quite permissible under certain rules of what the subject is, that you say, I don't think you, or Ho Chi Minh for that matter, knows what they're talking about in this case. And the cadre's job was to try to draw this out and turn the guy around. Mostly, you know, let him vet the subject. Fourth was mass media communications, which was designed as a reinforcement of the others. There was Radio Liberation, Radio Hanoi, but these were not aimed at the guy in the Rice Paddy. These were what we called esoteric forms of communication. They were aimed at the cadres, who then were to take whatever these messages were and translate them into simpler messages and use them in their work. Well, this four-part structure was a theoretical formula employed. First, what it tried to do was to establish a claim to truth in terms of basic rational appeal. What I have to say here is the truth, and it's logical, and you should believe it. Now, this was not a full-blown ideology, Marxism or any other, so much as it was a conversion of specific ideas into action, and the transformation of abstract concepts such as nationalism into social level. Then, using non-rational appeals, the emotions of the villagers were tapped, and as were the passions, chiefly the emotion or the passion of hatred. Hatred was generated. And finally, on the basis of this hatred, a commitment to action was demanded, even if it was just some token or act or gesture. Communication of ideas was viewed not as a separate act, but as an integral part of the revolution. Communication was a seamless web based on Orthodox Lenin's distinction between agitation and propaganda. An agitator is one who presents only one or a few ideas to a mass of people. A propagandist is one who presents many ideas to one or a few persons. Propaganda particularly has a bad odor in our society. It usually means something that's not true and a lie. Its roots, as you probably know, was in the Catholic Church. Propaganda was to propagate the faith. And it's, of course, a very honorable and worthwhile effort. In the Soviet Union, particularly, this was raised to a fairly high art. The agitators went into factories, and when the workers were sitting around eating lunch, he would get up and make and engage in agitation, a series of slogans, or emotionally aroused, but just a few ideas. The original in the Soviet case was bread and land. That's what we stand for. We bread and land, nothing else. So this was drummed in over and over. Whereas they had party people that were running. Yeah, they were trained for this, and some of them were very good. I don't know, the guy eating his sandwich, whether he listened to him that much or not. But and then the same ideas that this adjutant, a few ideas, a propagandist back in Moscow then is writing long, usually turgid articles for the party newspapers and the party magazines. And that's propaganda. And this is very esoteric and, you know, intellectual and so on. Essentially, the same ideas are being communicated, but by different means. Agitation, then, was mostly sloganeering. A few ideas repeated and explained in simple terms. Propaganda, on the other hand, was much more intellectual. Theoretical indoctrination through which party members were armed with scientific laws of knowledge, which govern society and explain history. That's pure Marxism there. Hard to judge the effects of this. They continue this. The communists today continue it right down to the the camps, the re-education camps in South Vietnam. My wife edited a book by one who had spent 5 years there called Lost Years, it was called. And it was written by a Arvin captain and school teacher who is now in London about life in these re-education camps. And he describes in one place the cadres coming in from Hanoi to lecture to these people about Marxism, Leninism, and communism. And all they were agitators, really. They were not propagandists. And all they had was a few slogans, which they'd been taught and which they used in this indoctrination. And so then in the question period, these people, Southerners, are being re-indoctrinated, including, you know, college professors, and a couple of people in this camp who had studied Marxism, Leninism at Stanford. One of them had a PhD, and he gets up and he asks various questions about it was a kind of game, of course, and the poor cadre would try to come up with a slogan that sort of fit whatever this question was. And it was kind of a dangerous game to play, of course, because you couldn't make a fool out of this guy without. I mean, so that he realized what you were talking about. It must have been quite enjoyable to these people. Often thought if I was ever kept captured by the VC, I would use my knowledge of Marxism and Leninism against them. I would say, well, you certainly believe in Marx, and Marx does not believe in hanging people by their thumbs, and surely you're a good communist. And I don't know if that would ever work. It would have been a dangerous game to play also. Remember this one example in this camp where this woman got up and said, the cadre said, you really should hate the American imperialists. You know, they did wretched things in this country. And this woman got up and said, yes, I really hate the Americans. He said, that's very good. Why do you hate the Americans? Well, because they ran off and left us with the communists. And she was apparently so sincere in this that the cadre didn't know whether she was pulling his leg or not. Was the sort of game that went on. Probably went on all through the war with the true believers in the North. Anyway, the success of this communication program was not due to the Marxist content. It was due to pragmatic arguments. The appeals were rooted in fundamental communist doctrine, such as the United Front concept, class consciousness, dialectical materialism, history interpreted in economic terms, mode of production, and the historically determined inevitable triumph of the cause, which was an article of faith. The key communicator in this, at all levels, was the agitprop cadre, and he was no mere technician. He sat in the highest policy determining levels, right on all the way up to the Politburo. And at lower echelons, he tended to dominate all the activities, not just agitprop work. In the military, there was a dual command system of a military commander and a political commander, and the political commander, in effect, was the agitprop. he was a combination of many functions, really. He was a sort of a Well, as one agitprop cadre said to me, what was your job? He said, I was priest, policeman, and editorial writer. He'd been educated in France. But he was an instructor who explained Hanoi's policies and programs in terms of the ordinary rural Vietnamese could understand, using whatever arguments seemed most likely to be effective. Mass media, where it did exist, was never regarded as strong enough to convince people as the unconvinced. Well, the casualty rate among these people, these key cadres, was fairly high. The good second lieutenants would get killed in the first battle, and the rest go on to be become generals. People like this, a person who can go into a village or go into a town in Iowa and bring and give a speech that will bring people to their feet shouting, a person who can do that is a very rare individual. They're not easily found. And the ones that were being used in Vietnam, I say the casualty rate was fairly high. And so the quality of this Communication Act went down steadily. I remember being in one village in which these teams, they were called armed propaganda teams, and they were armed, but they were not. Did I tell you the story about the... they had guns, AK-47s, but their instructions were, you know, make them visible to sort of intimidate people, but your job as a cadre there is to convince these people. You're not there to threaten them or issue ultimatums and so on. Anyway, they got this one apparently fairly new cadre, and unfortunately he stuttered. So he began to this talk, and he begins to stutter. And everybody in the audience sort of giggles a little bit. And he looks at them and they stop giggling, and then he goes on. And he giggles again, and this time people giggle a little louder. And he stutters a third time, and even louder. So at this point, he takes off his AK-47, sets it on the table, and says, "I'm here to tell you some things." And he just, and he destroyed the whole principle of the agitprop cadre, which is that's, you don't point a gun at the head and say, "This is what you're going to believe." But I, as a public speaker, I can understand his feelings and his reaction. Well, finally, one thing more in review of this Vietnam War communication process, a bit on semantics. That is how language itself was turned by Hanoi into an enormously effective weapon for its use and into a quagmire or a verbal trap for the other side. What I'm talking about here is the substance of the communication process, what was said and the manner that was said. Hanoi cadres were able, particularly in remoter villages where there's not a lot of outside influence of outside thought, education, to a considerable extent, again dealing with semi-literate villages, to restructure both the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong semantic environment. And did this by introducing a new lexicon of terminology, what sociologists call altering perception by linguistically channeling thought. I think I noted in an early lecture, we have known, or we've always sensed, that thought is the product of language, that language defines and classifies, and that in defining and classifying, our language automatically structures our universe, causes us to see things in certain ways. In the same way, we have long been aware of the intimate and mysterious, but still largely unknown relationship between words and ideas. All we know for sure is that words allow us to articulate our ideas, and our ideas cannot be said to be truly existing until or unless we have words to express them. This can be illustrated, perhaps unfairly, by the language game was once popular among the South Vietnamese cadres who were talking to North Vietnam cadres who had been captured in these prisoner of war camps. So, "I am militant, you are aggressive," and this is what they're saying to you. "I lead, but you dominate. I liberate, but you make war. I assist, but you invade. I am well organized, but you are bureaucratic. I am disciplined, but you are stubborn. I am a belligerent peace lover, but you are a cowardly warmonger. I eliminate tyrants, but you kill people. They're really talking about the same act, but it's simply a different term, words that are used. This was not unique in any way in Vietnam. The Nazis had what they called linguistic regulations. The militarist Japan had thought control. Not only the Leninist indoctrination system, agitprop, but the whole concept of the new Soviet man, which developed in the 60s, early 60s, the idea of creating a new human being in Russia. And, of course, this is also very true in fiction. George Orwell's brilliant satire, 1984, I commend it to you. And it's a satire on Soviet communism and socialism. That what Big Brother introduces in 1984 is what's called newspeak, in which war is defined as peace, freedom is defined as slavery, and so on. And it's handled so beautifully, it really conveys this sense of, well, in the case of the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese, no one was ever shot or decapitated in either their language or their documents. He was punished, or the front had exercised its power. The victim was never a civil servant, but a puppet repressor, or a cruel element. Never a policeman, but a secret agent or a lackey henchman. Never an American, Korean, or Thai, but an imperialist aggressor or an imperialist aggressor lackey. One was not a member of a political or religious group, but a key reactionary, a recalcitrant element, and there's more than one, in an oppressive organization. Always cruel fascists were brought to justice, or criminal acts against patriots avenged, or the front carried out its severe verdict against the aggressor, not that non-combatants were slaughtered. Now, this was not just a semantic gambit for the benefit of outsiders. Internal documents intended only for circulation among party insiders employed the same delicacy. A whole range of terms and words were studiously avoided. Any subject involving coercion, non-egalitarianism, privilege, or rank were only alluded to or circumnavigated. We were always getting rockets from Washington saying, find these captured documents, and they talk about how bloody-handed they are, and publish them, use them. And we kept sending them. There aren't any like that. They don't write that way, even to themselves. Well, to the extent which this systematic manipulation of North Vietnamese symbolic environment altered perception of behavior could never be measured, certainly objectively, and certainly not in Hanoi, because we never had adequate access. Probably it is true that reality about the war in Vietnam was not the same as reality in, say, the United States. Yet to this day, we are not sure. Well, I don't know if any of that makes sense to you. Think about it. Maybe I'll have a question in the final exam on it. None of you is a sociology major, I think, is that right? Or a mass comm major? Yeah, well, this should add some meaning to you. All right, next time. Is any of you political science majors? What are the rest of you? What? I guess I knew that once.
I don't know how to say it before,
just shrug your shoulders.
Okay.
That's the universal language.
Yeah.
think that's a better one.
Yeah, yeah. The,